The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive.
Today we are immersing ourselves in just a truly unique work of classical philosophy. It's one forged in the absolute harshest possible environment, The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius.
Yeah, and harsh is really the word for it. This isn't, you know, abstract theory cooked up in a library.
Not at all.
This entire book was written by a man who genuinely had everything: wealth, high status, immense political power, and then, boom, lost it all, just like that.
Overnight, yeah.
Thrown in prison, awaiting execution on charges of treason. So the book is his final, almost desperate attempt to use reason, philosophy itself, to find some kind of peace.
And that context, I think, is what lifts this book. It goes from being just a historical text to something like a manual for resilience.
So our mission for you, the listener, is to explore how we can actually use philosophical thinking to find real deep consolation when we're faced with, you know, profound suffering or just staggering injustice. Mm-hmm. Can the mind really find freedom even when, well, the body is literally in chains?
And the relevance today, I think, is huge, because Boethius tackles that timeless question: why do bad things happen to good people?
Right.
And his answer, which he develops through this dialogue with a figure called Lady Philosophy, it's a pretty radical shift in perspective.
That's so.
It basically aims to turn misfortune from this awful tragedy into, believe it or not, an opportunity for intellectual and spiritual growth.
Okay, so let's unpack the author himself. Who was this guy? Anicius Manlius Verinus Boethius lived around 480 to 524 CE.
Yeah.
History calls him the last of the Romans and the first of the Scholastics. That title alone tells you he's standing right at this like major turning point between the ancient world and the Middle Ages.
Oh, absolutely. He was an intellectual and political giant, no question. Hmm. Born into one of the most prominent Roman families, you know, the NEC, climbed every rung of the ladder.
Like all the way.
All the way. Roman senator, consul. And then he became the Magister Officiorum. Think of that as like the chief of staff for the whole government.
Wow.
Under the Gothic king Theodoric the Great. So, yeah, he had the complete package of worldly success.
But his real passion, his true ambition, seems to have been scholarly, right?
Totally. He saw that Greek knowledge, Greek philosophy, was literally vanishing in the Western world at that time.
Right.
So he set himself this almost unbelievable task: translate all of Plato and all of Aristotle into Latin.
Just casually deciding to translate everything.
Exactly. He wanted to preserve that entire classical tradition for us, basically, for future generations. Mm-hmm. He was trying to cement that intellectual legacy.
And it's that mix, isn't it? That combination of huge political power and really deep philosophical training. That's what makes this book feel so, I don't know, authentic.
Yeah, it is. Because he really tasted the absolute peak of worldly success, only to have it all violently ripped away.
Charged with treason, probably falsely.
Almost certainly falsely, yeah. So the Consolation isn't some abstract lecture from an ivory tower. It's philosophy being tested in the actual fire, the crucible of his own despair. That gives it this incredible urgency.
Okay, let's get into the book itself then. The structure alone is pretty unusual. It's a prosimetrum.
Right. Fancy word.
Yeah, basically meaning it alternates, doesn't it, between like logical prose arguments and then these more emotional, lyrical poems.
It creates this really interesting texture. It's an intellectual journey and an emotional one happening at the same time.
And the whole thing is framed as a conversation, a dialogue. Mm-hmm. You've got Boethius, the prisoner, just sunk in despair, and he's visited by this figure, Lady Philosophy. She's literally wisdom personified.
And she's described as this majestic woman, right, whose height seems to, well, it changes, sometimes reaching the heavens.
Symbolizing the vastness of wisdom itself, I guess.
Exactly.
But she doesn't exactly start with, like, gentle, comforting words, does she? It's more like tough love.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. She starts with a diagnosis. Sorry. She tells him his problem is spiritual amnesia.
Amnesia.
Yeah. He's forgotten his true nature. And crucially, he's based his happiness on things that are fleeting, external, stuff outside of himself.
So he's grieving because he put his faith in things that were never really his to keep.
Precisely. He misplaced his happiness. So the core idea, the premise of the book, is that philosophy is the ultimate spiritual therapy.
Okay.
Lady Philosophy, step by step, just dismantles his belief in these false roots to happiness power, fame, wealth, pleasure.
Rips them apart logically.
Yeah, and then guides them towards true happiness, which she argues has to be self-sufficient, totally unified, and can only really be found in the highest good.
Which she identifies ultimately as God, or goodness itself.
Right. So the book becomes this rational roadmap for finding inner peace that can't be shaken, no matter what's happening outside.
That leads us nicely into the first part of her argument, then. The diagnosis and this whole idea about the fickleness of fortune. That's books one and two.
Right. Book one, she actually starts by kicking out the muses of poetry.
Yeah, she calls them sweet poison.
She does, because they're just kind of wallowing in his grief, maybe even amplifying it, instead of actually curing the root cause.
So what is the root cause, according to her?
She says his suffering isn't really caused by his imprisonment or his lost status. It's caused by a philosophical mistake.
Which is?
Believing those external things were ever necessary for his well-being in the first place. He's forgotten, she says, that the universe is actually governed by divine reason, not just random chaos.
Okay, so that sets the stage for book two, where we get this famous image of fortune.
Ah, yes, Fortuna, personified as this capricious goddess spinning her wheel.
Just randomly raising people up, casting others down.
Completely at random. And the key metaphor here is just so powerful. All those external goods we chase, wealth, honors, fame, power, they aren't really our possessions.
What are they then?
They're loans. Loans from fortune.
Okay. That reframes it completely.
Doesn't it? Because fortune's very nature is change. Inconstancy. So if you build your happiness on something that's guaranteed to change, like a loan you don't control, that can be recalled anytime.
And why are you so shocked and devastated when it does change?
Exactly. Yeah. Boethius, through philosophy, basically says, if you want stability, you have to stop pinning your hopes on inherently unstable things and stop complaining when you lose them.
That image of the loan is so potent. I mean, think about modern life, right? How often do we build our whole sense of self, our happiness, on things that are fundamentally unstable?
Like a job title.
Yeah, or a specific number in a bank account, or even things like youth or physical health. We think we own them.
But they're all loans from fortune, in Boethius's view.
And then comes that really paradoxical idea that adversity, bad fortune, is actually often more beneficial than good fortune.
It sounds crazy at first, doesn't it?
It does.
But the argument is that good fortune kind of masks our weaknesses. It makes us complacent, deceives us.
Whereas bad fortune.
Bad fortune forces us. It strips away the illusions, makes us confront reality, and compels us to dig deep and find our true internal resources, our inner strength.
So once she's kind of demolished these false ideas of happiness based on fortune, where does Lady Philosophy go next? Book three shifts gears, right?
It does. Book three is all about defining what true good actually is. The summum bonum.
The highest good.
Right. She argues that every single human being, just by nature, is seeking this highest good. That's what we're all ultimately aiming for, whether we realize it or not.
But the things we usually chase, power, wealth, pleasure, those aren't it.
No. She says those are just partial, flawed, fragmented attempts to grasp that one perfect goodness. True happiness, she argues, must be completely unified, totally self-sufficient, and perfect.
And through this chain of logical reasoning, she concludes that this perfect unity and goodness, that's God.
Exactly. So achieving real happiness isn't about getting stuff. It's about participating in that divine goodness. Through reason and virtue, living a rational, ethical life aligns you with that highest good.
Okay. That structure then leads us right into the heart of Boethius' own personal agony in book four, The Problem of Evil.
Yes. The big one.
If there's a good, rational order, why do bad people, like the ones who falsely accused him, seem to thrive while good people suffer?
And philosophy's answer here is really, really radical. It draws heavily on Neoplatonic ideas.
What does she say?
She claims the wicked aren't actually winning. They're inherently weak.
Weak. But they often have all the power. They're running things.
Externally, yes. But philosophy argues they're weak because they fail to achieve their natural true purpose, which is happiness and participating in the good.
Okay.
Evil, she says, isn't some powerful force in itself. It's a privation. Like darkness isn't the thing. It's just the absence of light. Evil is the absence of goodness, the absence of being, almost.
So when someone chooses evil, what happens to them, according to this?
By choosing evil, they inflict a punishment on themselves far worse than any court could hand down. They cease to be fully human. They lose their connection to reason. Their true self disintegrates. They think they're gaining power, but they're actually destroying themselves spiritually from the inside out.
So instead of envying them,
we should pity them. Their success is an illusion that hides profound inner failure.
And this whole framework of justice, it fits within a bigger cosmic picture, right? This distinction between providence and fate.
Exactly. Providence is like God's eternal, unchanging, unified plan for everything. The divine reason that governs the cosmos all at once.
Okay. And fate?
Fate is just how we experience that plan unfolding in time, sequentially, moment by moment, down here on Earth.
So what looks like random chaos or unfairness to us
is actually part of a perfectly ordered, though hidden, cosmic plan that is ultimately just. Nothing happens without reason, even if we can't see it.
Yeah. Okay, that brings us to the final hurdle in Book V, the philosophical grand finale. Free will versus divine foreknowledge.
The classic paradox.
Yeah. If God already knows everything we're going to do, how can our choices possibly be free? Aren't we just puppets? This must have been critical for Boethius, wondering if his own struggle for justice even mattered.
Absolutely. And this is arguably Boethius' most lasting contribution to Western philosophy.
Hmm.
His solution is incredibly clever. It hinges on redefining how we understand God's existence.
Yeah.
Specifically, God's relationship to time.
Okay.
He defines God's eternity not as just lasting forever through time, like an infinitely long timeline.
Right.
Instead, he defines it as, this is a famous phrase, the whole, simultaneous, and perfect possession of boundless life.
Hmm. Okay. Whole, simultaneous, perfect possession of boundless life. That's dense. Can we break that down a bit?
Let's try an analogy. Imagine you're watching a parade pass by. You only see the float that's right in front of you at any given moment. That's how we experience time sequentially, bit by bit.
Okay, like linear time.
Right. Now imagine someone is watching that same parade from a helicopter high above. They can see the entire parade route, the beginning, the middle, the end, all at the same instant.
I see. They see it all at once.
That's kind of like God's eternity, according to Boethius. God doesn't foresee our future choices in the way we think of looking ahead down the timeline.
So God isn't predicting?
No. God simply sees all of time, our past, our present, and our future choices, all simultaneously, in one unified, eternal now.
Okay, so God's knowledge doesn't cause our choices any more than the person in the helicopter causes the parade to move.
Exactly. God's knowledge simply is reflecting the reality of the choices that we freely make within our own temporal frame. Just because the helicopter viewer knows the final float is coming doesn't mean they forced it to be there.
That distinction preserves both God's omniscience and our genuine moral responsibility for our actions.
That's the brilliance of it. It's a very elegant solution.
Okay, that's a lot to digest. Let's try and distill this down into maybe three core takeaways for us today. What's the first big message?
I think the first one has to be the primacy of internal goods. True strength, true power, true happiness, it all lies in self-mastery, virtue, reason, not in external things like titles, money, or other people's opinions.
Right. The moment we start chasing those external things, we basically hand over control to fortune's wheel, don't we? We become vulnerable.
Totally. And the reflection for us is maybe instead of pouring all our energy into getting that next promotion or hitting a certain income level.
Focus on what?
Focus on the things that are intrinsically satisfying and truly yours, like mastering a skill, acting ethically, cultivating wisdom. Fortune can't recall those loans.
Okay, good first takeaway. What's number two?
The educational value of suffering. This is maybe the hardest one to swallow, but Boethius is insistent. Adversity isn't just pointless pain, it's a teacher, a necessary one.
It purifies and strengthens the soul.
That's the idea. It forces us to discover those eternal resources we didn't know we had. I mean, if Boethius hadn't been thrown in prison unjustly,
he never would have written this incredible book that's helped people for centuries.
Exactly. So the application for us is maybe using this framework for cognitive reframing.
Like when something bad happens, a setback at work, a relationship ending, a loss.
Instead of seeing it purely as tragedy, try to view it as a harsh but potentially valuable lesson.
Mm.
A forced opportunity to clarify what really matters, to build character. Adversity as a gift in a very rough disguise.
Very rough disguise, yeah. Okay, and the third key message.
Philosophy itself is spiritual therapy. The whole book is basically a demonstration that reason, logic, careful thinking, not just blind faith, can provide profound consolation for even the deepest sorrows.
So it empowers our own minds, right? It encourages us to use rational thought to analyze and dismantle those, like, emotional spirals that misfortune can trigger.
Precisely. It's like resilience training through philosophy.
The book is also just packed with really memorable lines, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Some real zingers that stick with you.
Let's share a few. Maybe start with the one that really captures that initial despair he's trying to cure.
Yeah, that's probably. For in all adversity of fortune, the most wretched kind of unhappiness is to have been happy.
Oh, yeah, the memory of good times makes the bad times feel even worse.
It does. But then Lady Philosophy offers the antidote, the core Stoic Platonic idea. Nothing is miserable unless you think it so. And on the other hand, nothing brings happiness unless you are content with it.
So perspective is everything. Happiness isn't just what happens to you. It's how you judge it, how you frame it internally.
Fundamentally, yes. And that leads to maybe my favorite line, the central promise of the whole book.
Go on.
If you are in possession of yourself, you will possess something you would never wish to lose and which fortune could never take from you.
Self-possession, mastering your own mind and responses. That's the one prize fortune can't touch.
That's the ultimate invulnerable treasure.
And we should probably include that definition that tackled the free will problem.
Right. Eternity, then, is the whole simultaneous and perfect possession of boundless life. A bit of a mouthful, but philosophically groundbreaking.
Okay, so let's bring this right down to earth. How can we actually apply these insights from a 6th century prison cell to our lives today?
Well, think about emotional resilience during a crisis. Say you lose your job unexpectedly.
Okay.
Boethius would advise, first, detach your core identity from that external event, from that job title. Remember, the title was just a loan from fortune.
Right. It wasn't me.
Exactly. Then shift your focus immediately to what you can control. Your internal response, maintaining your character, deciding your next ethical step. That's where your real power lies.
What about that feeling of injustice? It's so common. Maybe you see someone succeeding who you know is acting unethically, cutting corners, hurting people. It feels fundamentally wrong.
That's where you pull out book four. Remember philosophy's argument. Pity the wicked.
Pity them, even when they seem to be winning.
Yes, because their external success is shallow and temporary. According to Boethius, their unethical choices have inflicted a much deeper spiritual wound on themselves. They've damaged their own rationality, their own humanity.
So the real win is maintaining your own integrity, your own moral clarity, regardless of what they do.
That's the only victory that truly matters in the grand scheme of things, in that eternal present.
Yeah.
Because that's the only thing you truly possess.
That reframing is really helpful. And just that final idea, living as if under the gaze of a judge who sees all, whether you interpret that as God or just, you know, ultimate reality or conscience,
mm-hmm.
It encourages making choices based on long-term integrity or highest values rather than just chasing short-term gains or worrying only about immediate consequences.
Absolutely. It fosters a sense of accountability that goes beyond just the immediate social or legal ramifications.
So wrapping up, what was the most surprising thing for you in revisiting this?
For me, I think it was just how revolutionary the core claim still feels.
Yeah.
The true power is self-control, full stop. And that rigorous, logical, philosophical thought can offer a consolation as deep and complete as any other source, maybe even more so for some. It really validates the power of the human mind.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the lasting insight is really that concept of the inner citadel. The idea that our ultimate source of happiness, freedom, and peace lies within our own minds, our rational capacity. Boethius shows us from the depths of despair that we can cultivate this inner tranquil invulnerability,
mm-hmm.
that no external tyrants, no misfortune, no economic crash, nothing outside of us can ever truly penetrate or destroy. That's an incredibly empowering message, isn't it?
It truly is. Timeless.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.